how did you make Thunderbolt's acquaintance? I mean, how did you even hear about this guy, and what made you think, interesting?
Well, the idea first came from Nick Williams, who was interning for me at the time. And Nick and I were both pretty interested in Detroit, so we were checking out Detroit, and he came across this blog post about Thunderbolt. And so it was Nick who showed it to me and said, this guy looks like an amazing character. He was shot in the face when he was 11 years old. It sounds totally out there. And then I just called him up. That's really how I made his acquaintance.
Having talked to him once, did you have certain expectations going in? And were they at all what actually happened?
Well, when I went to Detroit, you know, I had no idea whether or not I was even going to get an interview. I mean, the way we ended that conversation was, give me a call when you're in Detroit, and we'll figure something out. And so I figured that the chances that I was actually going to be able to talk to him was fairly low, especially considering that, you know, I couldn't pay him or anything like that. So I really didn't know what to expect. I knew it was going to be a little bit dicey, and I was with a group of friends at the time, and I had already been telling them about the very first conversation that I had with him. And a couple of guys actually played rock, paper, scissors, shoot to see who would get to go with me. And that's how Noah ended up in that story, because I didn't want to go by myself.
I get that.
I didn't want to go by myself, but I didn't want to like bring a whole group of people either.
So they all wanted to go. They had...
The boys wanted to go. I don't think the girls were so keen on going.
You mean they weren't playing rock, paper, scissors, shoot?
No.
What is it about this guy that is so attractive, given that he's such an unattractive character?
Yeah, I wouldn't even necessarily say he's an unattractive character. I've always been much more interested in subjects who I don't know how I feel about them. And, I mean, that is Thunderbolt in a nutshell, you know. What I find really fascinating about him is that at the same time that he has to act as an enforcer and a bouncer and keep people in line, he also has to be this great host and really friendly. And his whole vibe all the time is, you hang out with me, you're going to have a crazy, amazing time and really fun. But if you step out of line, I'm going to cut your throat, you know? And I find that dynamic really fascinating.
So what is it about people who you don't know how you feel about that draws you in?
Because I just think there's more places that you can go with that. You know, if I was doing some sort of advocacy piece, or I wanted to expose someone for being a terrible person, or for being a really great person, obviously there's a lot of work out there that does that and does it really well, and it's really valuable. For me, I feel like there are so many more places that you can go and turns that you can take when you are dealing with a subject who is in these sort of moral gray zones. If Thunderbolt was like a monster, you know, that piece could not have been longer than 3 minutes, because you sort of established that. And then it would get really boring really fast.
Yeah. Did you ever feel unsafe when you were there physically?
Not really. My only concern was not getting the interview. When I first showed up, he asked me for money right off the bat again. And I said I didn't have any. And he said, well, did you at least bring me a gift? And I said, I didn't think to do that. And he claims that he had asked me for a gift when we first spoke on the phone. But I don't remember that part of the conversation. But anyway, so then we go into the house, and he's just not being very present. He's sort of like sitting down on the couch, and he's just kind of stamping around. And I'm rolling tape at this point, but I definitely don't feel comfortable enough to be actually like following him around. It's funny, because I think on the tape I come across as more nervous than Noah. And I think Noah was much more nervous for his safety than I was. I was just nervous about blowing the interview.
Right.
And it wasn't until I sent Noah out to go get get some booze and bring it back, that he sort of relaxed a little bit and we could actually sit down and start the interview.
Huh. So what were you thinking about negotiating those lines? Like, what were you thinking to yourself? Well, obviously I can't pay him because that would slant, you know, you just can't do it. But tequila, maybe.
Well, you know, the thing about paying subjects is I don't actually have a moral issue with subjects getting paid. And, I mean, talk about moral gray zones. I definitely, I think in conversations that I had with Thunderbolt, I at least strongly implied that the reason that I couldn't pay him was for moral reasons. And the fact of the matter is I have no money for this project. You know, anything, any expenses are out of my own pocket, and that's really what it comes down to. I really don't have an issue with paying Thunderbolt or really anyone for that matter. And I think that, you know, we as documentarians are kind of taking advantage of people and taking advantage of their stories. You know, maybe they have sort of a, if they have a political agenda, that's one thing. If they have a book to sell, that's another thing. But what do they get out of being open with us? It's a tricky situation, but I certainly don't have any moral qualms with it. And honestly, I actually don't even know what Chicago Public Media's policy is.
Well, they might have, you know, they might say yes to this brand of tequila and no to that brand. I don't know. Maybe we should look it up. I can guarantee there's no payment involved, though. So, Brendan, at what point did you come into this project and thinking about what you were going to contribute?
Well, Nick and I had been talking about collaborating for a while, and Nick was in New York, which is where I live. We got together, and he was telling me about a couple story ideas that he had, one of which was this raw tape of Jay Thunderbolt, and I think the other one eventually became the show Man in the Road. And initially, we were thinking about doing Man in the Road, and that seemed easier from a sound design perspective, just because there were more distinct scenes. I could sort of imagine different sounds that would go with that particular show. But then, you know, when we were talking over email, Nick said, well, you know, I'm interested in doing the Thunderbolt tape specifically because it's going to be a harder radio piece to do sonically. There isn't as much of a narrative arc, and part of the challenge will be using music and sound effects and storytelling to kind of turn this raw tape into a complete piece. So the difficulty of it was kind of attractive from the get-go.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, I was afraid that the Thunderbolt tape was not strong enough to kind of hold together on its own. So I was thinking, well, maybe we can sort of distract people with all this awesome technical stuff that we're going to do.
Right.
Is that what you were thinking, Brendan?
I was a little worried. I don't know if I told Nick that, but when he said, no, I think we're really going to do the Thunderbolt tape, I was kind of like, oh, man, because the other show, Man in the Road, is a great show as well and a very interesting story and has more of a traditional narrative arc to it. So, you know, I love a good challenge, but at the same time, I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess we're gonna take the harder road here.
Did things suggest themselves to you when you first heard the tape? How did this your end of the project start, you know, growing?
My process was really just to kind of listen to the piece and to sit down with, initially it was a keyboard and a guitar and just play some motifs, some little musical ideas that popped into my head as I was listening to them. But to be perfectly honest, those first few drafts, I don't think I was really understanding who Thunderbolt was, or I don't know if those musical ideas that I began with, I don't know if they really captured the tone of what it would feel like to be in that environment with Nick and Noah.
Mm-hmm.
So what I ended up doing was taking mixes of those ideas and just continually editing them and processing them. So I was always kind of starting with some of the same core motifs and then continuing to manipulate them until they felt more appropriate for the scene.
And was there a time when you finally felt like you got something that you wanted, or was it just a process of kind of going back at it over and over and over again, and every time you'd sit down, you know, different ideas would occur.
I think sort of Nick was talking earlier about his attraction to characters with some ambiguity.
Mm-hmm.
And those moments in the tape were the moments that I started out with, moments where you saw that he was, you know, a person beyond this job that he has, beyond the strip club owner. So when he talks about his parents, when he talks about his dog, that's kind of turning a page and letting you see this whole other chapter of his life. And that really kind of fleshes him out as a person. So those are the moments that I started with. And I had some piano motifs that I stretched and reorganized throughout the piece. But that was kind of the starting point.
And did the content of the piece, did his personality and the things that he said influence the processing of the music and the tone? I mean, I'm sure it must have to a certain extent. Do you know what I mean? I'm not sure if I'm
clear.
Yeah,
I mean, I tried to kind of amp up the music when he was getting more aggressive, and I tried to make it more ambient and soft when he was getting more sentimental. But scoring is always a tricky thing because you're trying to manipulate your audience. You're trying to make them feel the same thing that you feel when you're listening to something, and that's a form of manipulation. And I was a little bit worried that at times it might be too didactic, or like I'm, you know, hitting people over the head, like this is my interpretation. And I think especially on that first draft that I sent to Nick, one of the ways that we dealt with that in our collaboration was Nick was sending me notes about the music that I had written, and was really encouraging me to move away from acoustically derived sounds more towards processed and electronic sounds, which kind of pushed me away from sentimentality, I guess, or at least that's what I hoped for,
mm-hmm.
hoped happened.
And did you guys, how did the collaboration work? You just went back and forth and back and forth?
Yeah, more or less. Nick sent me an almost complete raw edit, and I started sort of filling out little scenes piece by piece. And I would say at the beginning of the collaboration, at least on my end, it took a lot more time to kind of establish the ideas. And then as we got closer to a finished piece, the whole thing started building up much more quickly and fitting together, kind of like a puzzle. You know, you're putting a puzzle together and you get piece by piece. And then all of a sudden the image kind of finally appears and like, oh, okay, that's what I was making. And that was sort of my experience, at least doing the music and sound design for it.
Well, one of the first things that Brendan did when I sent him, I sent him a totally dry cut. And one of the first things that he wrote back to me is, I need rules. And so I just sat down and kind of brainstormed some very arbitrary rules just as sort of like a jumping off point. And I think we basically violated all those rules by the end of the piece.
Right.
But like one of them was, let's do one section where we rip off the Happiness Project, you know, literally taking notes from his voice or taking his voice and transposing that into note form. And we ended up taking that out because it was just way too on the nose and also sounded exactly
that,
like that.
That might have been an example of a piece that was maybe too sentimental. But like what the Happiness Project that Nick referenced is this guy, Charlie, what's his name? Charlie?
I'm totally blanking.
Yeah, he's part of the Broken Social Scene Collective, I think.
Yeah,
anyway,
yeah.
It's an album where he's taking interviews and using the contour of people's voices and the rhythm of their speech and translating that to instruments. So someone will say, you know, a sentence, and then you'll hear that repeated in, you know, a horn or something. So I started doing that, and it worked, but did you say, Nick, it was a little too on the nose?
Yeah, exactly. And then I think the other thing, too, that we did early on was, I mean, I was definitely thinking of this piece like almost like a music EP as opposed to a documentary where there's like individual songs,
mm-hmm.
which also would be analogous to chapters, I guess. So I think it was pretty early on. I don't know exactly when it was in the process, but I sent you, Brendan, like just a list of all the different chapters and kind of the tone of each one. And so that helped to kind of break it apart.
I mean, and it was important for me just to sort of have these limitations to start off with. Otherwise, it would have been almost a too daunting project. Just to start is hard, and to say like, well, try to create something that fits these set of challenges is a nice way to get the ball rolling.
Right, right. Creativity by constraint, we always say. Mm-hmm. So now you have so many characters in the piece, even though it seems like there's only one. It seems like there's Jay Thunderbolt. Nick is a character. The music is a character. The scoring is really kind of a character. Did you guys both think about that at all, especially in the editing and in the scoring?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I've for a very long time thought of the editor as a character. And, you know, I think that's a real disadvantage that we have in the radio world. It's both an advantage and disadvantage working in audio only, which is that we can completely hide all our edits. You know, we can take out an we can totally smooth things over and make people completely unaware.
We can make people say
process.
Things that they didn't say. Not
right.
That we did that. But.
Right. And so it's nice to be able to do that. At the same time, I do think we sort of lose out on something pretty vital that you really get when you watch a film. Like when you watch a film, almost every single cut, you can sort of do a jump cut. You can get around things here and there, but it's much more difficult. In general, when you're watching a film, you're always at least subconsciously aware of all the directorial
decisions
that are right. going into mm-hmm. it, or at least editing decisions.
Well, for my part, I don't necessarily think of music as a character as much as I think of it as a kind of scenery, like set design. Because in radio, in order to set a scene, you either have to describe it really well or get sound effects that give you a mental image of what this place visually looks like. And when I sit down to write music or make sound effects, a lot of what I'm interested in has to do with like space, like where the sounds are oriented in sort of the stereo field and how that can make you feel something or change the mood of a piece or change the mood of a scene. And I know that people say things in film like the scenery is a kind of character. So in that way, yes, I agree. But for me, it's rather than thinking of music as a character, I'm thinking of it as almost visual images or translating sounds into visual images.
I find Brendan's work very three-dimensional, you know. And I mean, one thing that this is a little bit technical, but we recorded... I recorded Thunderbolt in a mono microphone, and Brendan created sort of a fake stereo that really kind of opens up the space and created ambience. There's one part where, and it's very, very subtle, Thunderbolt goes, when he's describing getting shot at point blank range at 11 years old, he goes this close. And that sounds like this.
It's as if we intentionally faded the sound to sound as if he was getting closer to the microphone.
Yeah, and that was something that was not in the original mix. That was something that Brendan added.
So he
afterwards.
Did not get close to the microphone and say like this.
Right.
You guys manipulated that.
Right, or Brendan did. I mean, he.
Yeah.
He didn't even tell me he was doing that, and then I was listening to it again. I was like, God. And it's very
well,
subtle,
but
it does create this real three-dimensional space, which I think is something that Brendan does really well.
Yeah, and I also really like creating those kind of Easter eggs, those little things that are subtle, and that if you're a really close listener, that you maybe pick up on a second or third listen, so that the piece does have a life after its first play.
How did you guys meet or start working together?
Nick and I first met at Nick's festival Megapolis was that 2009?
Yeah, that was the first time that we met. And then Brendan actually did a presentation at the second Megapolis that we did.
That's so cool.
So Brendan did that, and then, I think that was sort of the real jumping off point. And then I think since then we had always talked about the potential of collaborating.
What project was this constructed for?
So this was an episode of my podcast Love and Radio, which is something I've been doing for off and on for about 5 years now, and it's taken many, many forms, but for much of its history it's been sort of like my little sandbox where I get to try out new new things.
Is this indicative of the kind of tone, level of creativity that's on the podcast all the time?
I mean, I like to think the other stuff definitely holds up. I mean, this is definitely the piece that I'm proudest of that we've made so far, and I'd certainly like to continue going in this direction. Yeah.
And this is the budget that comes out of your pocket, yes?
for now, but we'll see. We'll see what the future holds.
What do you want listeners to come away with after they hear this story?
Oh, I definitely don't want them to come away with any particular thing. I think that's cheating. I mean, I will say that I want people to be surprised. I want people to go into that story and into that room and experience stuff that they wouldn't necessarily expect. I think oftentimes when you hear a story on the radio, oftentimes there's this emphasis on the host or the narrator explaining what does this all mean. And I like the ambiguity, and I like people to walk away with whatever piece I'm doing with different interpretations of it. I have my own personal thoughts about what's going on, but I definitely wouldn't say that there's one way to think about this piece.
So now I have to ask you what your thoughts are.
I don't know if this answers the question of what's important or what it means, but I can definitely say that what I find interesting is the fact that Jay has these multiple roles in a literal sense, like in terms of his work, that he's the bouncer and he's the DJ and he's the party planner, and in terms of his relationship with me and presumably also with his clients as well, that he has to simultaneously keep people in line and show them a good time. He needs to tell them, hey, if you hang out with me, you're going to have a blast. But if you cross a line, I'm going to rip your throat out. And so, I mean, that to me is a tension that I just find really fascinating. How narrow the border is between violence and friendship, you know? There's a documentary filmmaker by the name of Victor Kosakowski who has these rules for documentary film. And the one that sticks out for me is don't film something you just hate. Don't film something you just love. Film when you aren't sure if you hate it or love it. Doubts are crucial for making art. Film when you hate and love at the same time. I typically am interested in subjects where I don't really know how I feel about the subject. I like that ambiguity. And by going out and hanging out with them and recording them, it helps inform me sort of a bigger picture of who they are. I think the gray areas are what are most fascinating.